Blog Talk Radio.
Walking down the street, smoggy eyes, looking at the sky.
To share with you today in our dialogue, where we hope to address some very serious issues that are confronting our communities today. Let me begin by again welcoming all of you back for our second show, and to give you a brief description, as you've seen in the announcement for the show. Some question the value of life in America and its society as a whole. After 151 years of freedom in America, for the oldest minority group, there are still unresolved social frustrations with America. During this powerful, informative broadcast, we will have my special guest, Dr. E. Kelly Sanford, professor of sociology at Tennessee State University. And together we will address social issues faced by African Americans. Don't miss this opportunity to weigh in, and you can call tonight. Our call-in number is 657-383-0944. Again, that's 657-383-0944. And a little bit down the road here in the show, we will be happy to entertain your calls and your comments, your questions and comments. But again, this is Talk Straight with your host, Reverend Reuben Dockery, and we're going to be sharing again in just a little bit with our special guest. But prior to that, let me give a little context for our conversation tonight and the basis of what we're doing here. I think it's important to understand that we have a history in America as a subgroup of people. And to give some context to the conversation that we're having, let me begin here. December 24, 1865, the Ku Klux Klan was formed by six well-educated Confederate veterans in Pulaski, Tennessee. They were John C. Lester, John B. Kennedy, James R. Crow, Frank O. McCord, Richard Reed, and J. Calvin Jones. Now, they began this organization primarily to defend what they believed was their right to the institution of slavery and the control of Negroes who were formerly slaves, but at this point set free by December of 1865. This was perhaps the first instance where we saw individuals seek to protect what they believed was their God-given right to controlling other human beings. February 27 of 1870, Congress passed the 15th Amendment of the United States Constitution, and it provided the right of Negro males to vote. Consequently, the first Negro was elected to the United States Senate. His name was Hiram Revels from Mississippi. And subsequently, six others were elected to the United States House of Representatives after Negroes gained this newfound right to suffrage. Those individuals were Joseph Rainey of South Carolina, Jefferson F. Long of Georgia, Robert C. DeLarge of South Carolina, Robert B. Elliott of South Carolina, Benjamin S. Turner of Alabama, and Josiah T. Walls of Florida. This was perhaps the first indication of the benefit of being free and having the right to participate in American society as any other citizen. And these men exercised that along with others. Frederick Douglass was the founder of the Liberty Party in 1868, and subsequently they were able to get this law passed, this amendment passed, such that Negro men can vote, and they took full advantage of it. 1970, 100 years later, after black men began to vote, we found ourselves in a situation where when they realized that national legislation that has been passed for years, the nonviolent movement, and the continuous promise of welfare to fulfill the needs of poor Afro-American people, there were some young men across America in various cities, particularly Chicago, who formed gangs or black gangs. One of them was Larry Hoover. He started the Gangster Disciples, and primarily his justification was to provide both social and economic security for those that were part of this group. Jeff Fort, noted as starting the L. Rookins in Chicago, and they had a religious flair to it, but it also had the same aim. Across the country well, before I go there, Willie Lord started the Vice Lords in Chicago as well, and they were intending to look out for the social and economic well-being of these young men who had found disappointment as well. And then across the country, in west, out west in California, Los Angeles to be specific, Stanley Tookie Williams is noted as starting the Crips gang, and they perceived that they needed to protect themselves. And they need to look out for themselves. Thus, they started the Crips. Interestingly enough, across town in the Pierce Housing Project of Compton, a group started by Raymond Washington by the name, calling themselves the Bloods. And largely, they protected themselves from encroachments of the Crips. Now, these are not the only gangs in America, but these are the major gangs that have widespread appeal in America. And it's important to realize that, again, 100 years after the right to vote, these young men across America saw the need to form what we call gangs today. And interestingly enough, today, it is these gangs still exist, and they drive the social ideologies of a lot of young people. I won't say everybody, but a lot of young people who seek to find security, to find some sort of sense of economic stability and independence, and in their minds, this is how we do so. Oddly enough, in addition to the gangs, we now have groups such as Black Lives Matter coming to bear. And I believe that what we see is a response to, again, the failure socially from one generation to the next. As we just pointed out, 1865 was the formal period in which freedom came. But let me share this little commentary with you, and pretty soon we'll be able to bring our special guest in, Dr. E. Kelly Sanford from Tennessee State University, a professor of sociology, and we certainly want to hear from him in terms of that context. But again, let me briefly share with you this commentary, historical commentary. And interestingly enough, this comes from our lecture series that we're bringing across America in 10 cities. I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a while. Afro-male aggression exhibited throughout urban America today is the result of what I'm calling a violent continuum. The continuum begins with ignorance about self, frustration stemming from false assumptions morph into fear-driven anger and adversity in society. Prolonged anger turns into anxiety. Ultimately, unprocessed anxiety, manifests itself into extreme self-inflicting violence. And we see this within major cities across America. Ironically, the main object of displaced Afro-male violence is the very village, as we say, from whence the African-American male tend to come. The African-American male subgroup has existed in America for approximately 395 years, if we go back to when first introduced to American society in 1619, arguably 1620. However, African-American males have been formally free in America as citizens for now 151 years, five generations ago. His ethnic character has been shaped largely by political, economic, and social trends. Rather than operating solely from his own agenda, he has heavily depended on the plans and interests of others. Tragically, important lessons learned by males of previous generations have been lost over time, leaving the present generation in serious doubt about their place and their right in America as citizens. Now, it is important to realize or to consider that in 1712, a key method used to dominate the Afro family unit was male dehumanization. This process came with both intended as well as unintended consequences. By December 18, 2015, last year, 150 years had passed since the start of government efforts, as indicated by the 15th Amendment, or the 13th Amendment, I should say, to empower the so-called Negro, colored, black, Afro-American, and now called African-American male, and allow him to assume his rights and privileges as an American citizen. Careful study of the Afro-American male evolution in America will reveal an unintended consequence of self-alienation from the American dream for a significant population of Afro-American males today. And what we see when we see anarchist-type behaviors and a fight against the government, it is everyone's right, if they believe that they're done wrong, to protest that and to speak that out. But what we see quite often is, particularly with black-on-black crime, the instance where we tend to turn on ourselves and to ventilate our violence, our frustrations through violence, and oftentimes the violence against one another. And this is how we manifest the character, particularly for a generation of people. Now, interestingly enough, it was the generations that preceded them. We're in the fifth generation now of freedom for Negroes in America, formerly. And this generation today appears to be more doubtful and concerned about their future than anyone ever before. Let's bring our guest in tonight, Dr. E. Kelly Sanford, who, again, as I mentioned earlier, is a professor of sociology at Tennessee State University. Greetings, sir. How are you?
Hello. Good evening, and thank you again for letting me be here.
Yes, sir. We're honored to have you. We're honored to have you. I assume you heard some of our conversation there and the background for our discussion tonight.
Absolutely. And that was a wonderful backdrop for understanding the legacy.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you. I would like for you, if you will, to tell us a little bit about your work. I know you work with one of my favorite authors, and one of the authors we use in our research, who talked about the Black family. Will you talk about your work there and a little bit, and give us some context for sociologically where you see the issue today with our young people?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I'm Dr. E. Kelly Sanford, professor of sociology at Tennessee State University. And there I teach an interesting course, being that this is the topic tonight, entitled Racism, a Sociological Analysis. And I think your backdrop on this issue of today is very much rooted in the fabric of the American culture. And when we think in terms of culture, we think of customs, knowledge, ways of being that's passed down from one generation to the next generation. So when you look at that 1619 for over 244 years of African enslavement, leading into the Civil War, where you picked up on that 1865, before we had so-called liberation from it. But then, of course, it had been so ingrained in what we refer to as the very fabric or social structure, meaning all of the institutions of the society. And therefore, that was the kind of like the backdrop that you mentioned that set it up for leading into a lot of the problems that still exist today. And so, when you think, you know, coming out of that Civil War, you know, you had the 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery. The 14th Amendment then gave citizenship, and then the 15th, as you mentioned, gave the right to vote. But then after that, we had this 81 years or more of Jim Crow laws that led into segregation and then to the Civil Rights Movement. And, you know, Dr. Charles C. McIntyre has a very interesting book. It's entitled Criminalizing a Race. And she looked at, after slavery, how we were reintroduced into the criminal justice system, into prison. And today, that's still very much the same part of this society that we lived in, even at that earlier time period, with things being disproportionate. But I hear you very clearly when you make that observation about what's going on in urban America and throughout America with disproportionate amount of African Americans being mistreated. It's so much of a part of just the white supremacy, if you can see how that's ingrained in the culture. And and it's just been a legacy that has occurred from an earlier period to now.
Right. You know, and Dr. Sanford, it's interesting because when you speak to young people today about the frustration that they have, it's difficult, if not impossible altogether, for them to articulate where it comes from. But they know there are issues that exist, and they're crying out for answers to at least deal with the feeling of threat. You follow what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And it gives rise to my purpose primarily, to really help understand historically, how do we get here? How do we get where we are? And, you know, as I really look at those gentlemen that I identified who started the major gangs across America, and they really spread themselves quite well. And in fact, I understand the disciples now and the vice lords have gotten to a point where they've organized themselves so well that they're educating people, sending them to college, and having them become lawyers and doctors and accountants and things of that nature. You know, they're investing in those type of things. So it's interesting that they would take that venue, but there are so many young people who really don't fully understand the context there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as we mentioned earlier, the reason they don't understand the context, unfortunately, that we've had this miseducation, as Dr. Carter G. Woodson would have talked
That's
about
it.
On the miseducation of the Negro. And as mm-hmm. we enter into school, even if you go there and try to be a good student, it has a tendency to leave out some of the fundamentals of what occurred in the past and make it connect to what's going on right now. So I think a lot of the young people that we refer to as millennials have a misconceived notion about the reality of what really is and what they think it is. So they kind of live in a fictitious or a delusionary type of environment that things are just okay right now and that they have these freedoms. And as a result of that, because I know you mentioned a very important piece 2 minutes ago about the gangs that has still existed from an earlier period to now, and they are organizing mm-hmm. themselves and always been in existence because they feel this whole cultural poverty that still exists. And I think they are rooted into understanding what is going on with the institution, the racism still alive and well. But we have so much variation, if you will, on just the notion of how we should go about dealing with it, that some subgroups are doing exactly what you said, have organized themselves, and even sending people to college to benefit and to try to bring change. But then we have others that have been a part of the middle class that might not necessarily support it or understand it that well. And then the millennials that are coming up are maybe so far removed from understanding the historical backdrop that they're just not conscious enough to want to take part in it to in a great degree. And to some instances, not even understanding well enough to know that they should know what they should be about trying to bring about change to support others.
Right. You know, I believe there's something to the argument that, and you let me know where you are with this, that today too many people from past generations, I mean those that are, I'll say 40 years old and older, are deleteriously misleading young people today to think that their greatest fight is with society. Where are you with that?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm not even sure if some of that group that are 40 and over are even having a true conversation with the younger ones. It seems historically, coming out of the fight for equal rights and the whole civil rights movement, that there was this hope, this thought that, well, if we don't inform our next generation about it, that maybe everything will be fair and equal as we fought for it. And so, I think it was almost like a protective barrier with the hopes that things would just be okay for the next generation. So some of the information or the history was not shared when racism and prejudice was rooted toward family members in earlier generations. They may not have shared that with them or that plight with the hopes that their children and grandchildren would not have to face it. But it is still very much present, and I'm not in the thought process that they are aware of it. And let me just share this because it's kind of interesting you brought it up.
Okay.
In the early 80s, when I was working on finished my doctorate degree, and I was one of 25 scholars that went to Harvard in movement history. And Julian Barnes and many other scholars were there that were part of the civil rights movement. And we sat there, and the question that you have just presented, it was presented then. What will we do with those born in the 80s and the 90s? How can we get them to understand what happened to that whole movement from the Civil War or even earlier that through the Civil War to the present, that they would not be disconnected from that history? And there was a strong fear. Now, as a professor right now, I just seem to see that come to fruition, that we have people that are just totally oblivious of the past. and they have a tendency not to be connected. So I think there was kind of this hope, if you will, in society of grandparents and great-grandparents were hoping that their children and great-grandchildren would not have to suffer what they suffered, and to the degree they could put a barrier around them, and they had certain success economically and educationally to try to provide and not share. They thought probably what happened to them was just so negative to just not share it. And then they are not aware of it to see that it's still going on in a different way.
And that's interesting because the challenge is if you don't prepare them with the truth, they don't know how to develop themselves and to overcome even the challenges that their previous generation had while they deal with their own challenges within their own generation. And I speak of it in terms of a lot of young people even go to college with the notion that I'm going so I can get me a good job, not so that I can and act independently and own my own business and to contribute to the greater of society, but that I can be dependent on someone else's business construct.
And you're absolutely right. And I think that's a detriment.
Yeah. So a lot of young, and then when they don't find the jobs that they think they deserve or is commensurate with their, you know, with their experience and their self-identity, they become despondent and frustrated, and many of them just kind of give up. And it's amazing to me how many people who've been to college turn to drugs as a way of making a living.
Yeah.
And they would rather use education to justify illegal means of gaining resources than to actually do something that's within the construct of a legal business.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that's kind of connected also to the transition of the development of human society as we've moved out from grandparents and grandparents and maybe even parents in the labor force were able to survive and have a kind of like a middle-class income. Now in a highly technological society that we're living in, it is rather difficult. And many that are going to schools, they just don't have those jobs that are plentiful. In other words, there are fewer positions out there for people to then actually do exactly what their parents did. And their parents may have had a little less education, but would have been able to make more and to provide. And so it's hard to see that. And I think it gets frustrating. As a matter of fact, on an interview I just heard, a person mentioned how at one time, say for our generation, we would go to school, do our best, and we would be able to apply for a position and maybe get it and be gainfully employed. But now this generation, when they are coming out, those jobs are not there. They need to be able to think about innovative ways, as you just mentioned, coming up with business ideas of how to function on a middle-class level. And so it's quite different. I said that frustration is very much present, and I'm not even sure how living in this postmodernist society, technology has impeded the core values of education to be developed by our younger people in the same way as they were earlier. I think that's kind of pulling us away from being totally prepared for what's required.
Sure.
We've had a great shift with technology, but some of the values of higher education and some of the fundamental maturity aspects of education and knowledge are pretty much the same, although we live in a technological age. And so it still takes some development there to do well. So I'm just hoping that students will try to do a lot better. You've been in my classroom, so you know how it is.
Yeah, that's a good segue into the next conversation. I'd like to, now let me just preface this by explaining, I'm going to share a testimony. Testimony is a witness, and this is a testimony of an African-American male. The language is not very clean, but this is an academic discussion, So I'd like to see it that way. And on the other side of this, I'm going to ask anyone that's listening to give us a call and share in, give us your ideas or questions. Dr. Sanford does not mind entertaining any of your questions, nor do I. But give us a call at 657-383-0944. Again, that's 657-383-0944. And on the other side of this this song and this commercial, we're going to have a further discussion there. All right, give us 1 second here.
Hey, they call me Pook. I'm from these streets. Somehow, I live to see my 18th birthday. I managed to graduate from juvenile detention to adult prison. People try to tell me I should grow up being a man. But I'm the best man I know. Somebody asked, where I see myself 10 years. Man, I'm just trying to survive these streets day by day.
BFC Institute needs your help to reach the Pookies across America. Please support our traveling educational lecture series addressing perceived threats to African American males. To learn more, please visit us at bfcinstitute.com. That is bfcinstitute.com. Simply click the red sticker for details. Thank you.
and welcome back to Talk Straight with your host, Reverend Reuben Dockery. Tonight we have with us a special guest, Dr. E. Kelly Sanford, professor of sociology at Tennessee State University. We're talking about social frustrations with America. I think you just heard good context for the frustration that we're talking about. Rap music, interestingly enough, has taken on the character of expression for a lot of young people that are between 15 now and 45 years old. They can identify with it going back to the 80s or so. And prior to that, we had another style of music, but certainly rap has become a major communication source. Dr. Sanford, you want to speak about that? What impact do you think that rap music has on the mental status of the African-American male and African-Americans, period?
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon because, you know, the African-American experience in song, from the slave song to spirituals to gospel to leading up to jazz to every influence that we've contributed to. And it mm-hmm. always had this unique cultural thing of pulling out the mere experience of what was going on within the society. So I think as hip-hop and rap emerge in the culture, if you listen to some of the lyrics of it, you'll hear the pain and the agony that's going on within the community in many instances. And I know you have different forms of it, but in many instances, I think it's an expression of the same obstacles that were existent many years ago that younger people are expressing in their art form with hip-hop and rap music. So you have different forms of it, but I think they're telling the story, and the story sometimes is still pretty bleak. Just as it was coming out of slavery. So I think a story is being spoke there, like the spoken word, and they're telling the story of the pain, agony, the frustration, everything else that we've been talking about.
Right. You know, interesting, the latter song where the young man was talking about his mind's playing tricks on him.
Yeah.
What I found, and even when they made the song, and this was, I believe it was like 88 or so, something like that, when that song was made, the group basically found themselves telling a serious story, Doc. And the young man said his mind was playing tricks on him, such that he became paranoid, and he thought everything around him was coming after. Is that not where we are today with many of our young people, Doc?
I think it is. I think not only today, but I think it's just a continuation of things that have happened earlier. We've always had to deal with white supremacy, and different generations have had to adapt to it in different ways. So what happens when you have a false sense of reality about that being present, but it is happening to you? You don't know what's going on. It almost brings about a schizophrenic type of a situation that's in order to survive.
Wow.
And you don't know why you're doing it, but you are doing it. And you're adapting to some circumstances that you may not even be conscious or aware that's going on. Let's take for an example, if you try your best to do everything you should do, but then everything still goes against you, and you're wondering why after you've tried to meet all the demands of what you're supposed to do. And then when you think in terms of some of the legacy of what came out of slavery to the present and the Great Migration, let's say, and as we move by the millions into urban areas and one time gainfully employed, but out of industrialization when places started to close down, you have cultures of poverty, and with that, you have a lot of other pathologies that may have existed there that weren't so much the best of the culture of the people, but the conditions of the mere fabric of being in that particular condition would make a person have to suffer and have this frustration that the topic is talking about. And therefore, as you are moving through it as a younger person today, you are wondering, well, what can I do? I'm trying my best, and it seems like I'm not making any ground. You know, that nothing I do appears to be working in a successful way. So in order for me to survive, I have to go to alternative means. And so in the lyrics of what we just heard, I even heard the person considering suicide. You know, it makes you feel so alienated from the mere fabric of what you're trying to do that you reach a certain level of depression and having to live with it and deal with it every day as if that's normal. That's the norm.
You know, we tell young people, Doc, if you get an education and you work hard and you do something, things will work out. You'll have a fair shot. But and maybe there's a fallacy there that just getting an education, is there something else that as a subculture we need to impart in our young people?
Well, yes, I think we're living in this telecommunication society now that we have to be innovative. And you touched on it earlier about thinking about your own business, seeing how you can be creative and doing things that be successful within this new marketplace because the jobs are just not out there in large numbers as if it was during an industrial age where factories were very much present. And we can almost look at in Ohio when the steel factory was there and it gainfully employed, you know, thousands of people. But when it closed down, you had a whole group of people who were, you know, gainfully employed at one time but now not trained with education to fit into what's going on at the present time. So that causes a big problem. And that happened in many other areas throughout the United States. So, and then it's kind of an interesting phenomenon, too, because many of the positions that grandparents and great-grandparents would be willing to work, I think many younger people wouldn't dare consider doing those types of jobs, and other ethnic groups are doing those types of tasks today. So it's almost like there's this notion that we're too good for doing certain types of labor type of jobs that we don't want. And so then what's left is either you have those particular skills, you can be innovative to come up with certain economic and business plans. And then, of course, with racism, you might not be able to go to the bank and get the loans because of those barriers that are there, so you can't do it. And so what's left is some illegal activity.
Wow.
And then that's why people come up with some way of survival. And if it's been involved in drugs, and every morning we cut the television on, there's, you know, robbing, killing, and stealing. And
so these are just
manifestations of conditions.
Right. Do you mind if we take a call?
Absolutely.
All right. We got a call from 615. Caller, you on the air. You listen to Talk Straight with Reverend Doctor, and our special guest is Dr. E. Kelly Sanford. Go ahead. Caller?
Yes, hello, Pastor Doctor.
Hey, how you doing, sir? Welcome to Talk
hello.
Straight.
Hello.
Hey, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
All right, go ahead.
Doing,
you're live. You're on the air live. Go ahead.
I just kept in, man, and I was just, you know, making it known. I was going to tune in, just listen in and see what was going on.
Okay, all right. Well, we appreciate it.
Last couple of minutes. Dr. Sanford.
Hi, how you doing there, brother?
I'm good, thank you.
All right.
Yeah, just didn't get a chance.
Pastor, this is Pastor Ricky Waller. He was our guest on Tuesday, Dr. Sanford, and we highlighted a book that he wrote entitled Steel Hide, and he detailed his experiences from moving from a star athlete with great potential to go to college and, who knows, play in the pros to being caught up in the drug life, but God moved on him and allowed him to come now and to be a pastor and to try to transform lives in a positive way. So we're grateful that you tuned in with us, sir.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and it's just an awesome thing that you're doing. I just want to encourage those that that's tuned in, because it is very important. The last thing I heard was talking about how people get caught up into drugs, and it's not hard to get caught up into drugs. It's very easy because, you know, a lot of people, as such as myself, as Pastor Doctor was saying, you know, I took back with my life and thinking about I had a basketball in my hand as a very young guy, just playing simply in my yard with the ball. And I was excited about the basketball, but it's some things that I saw outside of my yard. And it became attracted to me, and it caught my every thought. So every day that
right.
I saw them standing, it started to increase in my mindset, and I end up becoming the very thing I saw. And I'm saying all that to say there's a lot of young people right today that's getting captured as a result of that. You know, you start out, you know, by way of just trying whatever it is that's going on. And suddenly, you know, it happened to me. I became the very thing. I started to supply my whole community. And a lot of people's lives was messed up as a result of that. So I just wanted to be able to encourage one if they may think about the book and may feel like the book may help the city and where you live or someone you know, a family member. It's got some great information in it. And this is one thing I'm going to say, and then I'm going to let you get back to what you all was talking about. I thought about with the guys, and this is talk straight, and so I wanted to make sure I do just that. When the guys were standing out and it looked like they was real hip, they had style, and the profile that they was putting out there, I happened to look at it and said, man, I sure would like to do what they're doing. But I didn't know I was going to become addicted to drugs. I didn't know that all these things were going to happen. So where I'm coming from is that the sharp man, he's the one that sees the evil and takes cover. See, I thought I was sharp, but I really wasn't. I was that one that was simple. I was that simple one, and I went straight on and got in big trouble. And everybody that was simple-minded got in big trouble with me, and I led a lot of people into the ditch because I went into the ditch. And so what God has done with me, he sent me back out there to try to help as many as I can to get out of the ditch. And that's what I wanted to share. I wanted to share that. You know, the sharp man, they may say he's a nerd, he's not hip, or he's a square, and all those things. But, man, that's the most hip one I ever known, man, the one that don't run into that tree. Yes, sir. They don't run into that trap because there is a trap set for us. And most of us captives, man, don't know how to get out of it. And it's a consequence of being.
Yeah, gratefully, that's what we're aiming to do, is to release some people from that trap.
Yes.
If you're listening, to Talk Straight with Reverend Dockery, and our guest tonight is Dr. E. Kelly Sanford, professor of sociology at Tennessee State University. Grateful for Reverend Ricky Waller to join us. And our topic is social frustrations with America. And if you're listening, feel free to give us a call. You can call us right now and be on live with us, share your comments, your questions at 657-383-0944. Again, that's 657-383-0944. Dr. Sanford, I wanted to, if you could just briefly, now, a lot of people will tell you that there's a common phrase on the street: I got to get it the way I live.
Yeah.
Since the system is stacked against me and I can't get a fair shot, I may drop out of high school, I got to get it the way I live. Will you talk to us a little bit about prescriptive and proscriptive norms and how they impact decision making?
Absolutely. That's a very good question, and I really appreciate the commentary that the Reverend mentioned. And I would like to start there by saying within certain cultures, some of the things that we try to cherish and value, and we look at value as a collective idea about what is good and right, but there can also be within a value bad and wrong. And then there's a norm. A norm is an established set of standards and laws that guide our behavior. So when you have a prescriptive norm, you're thinking in terms of the value that is good that can be reinforced within the culture in which we're in. But the proscriptive norm can come from the value that is bad and wrong. And that's and that could be a norm that guide our behavior as well. So in many instances, within certain particular populations that have been historically denied equal opportunity, it's not so much that mothers and fathers and children and people have these proscriptive types of norms that are inappropriate or bad, but it's the mere fabric of trying to survive in an environment. And as the Reverend just mentioned, you could be socialized to do good and right with a prescriptive or appropriate norm, but everything around you might look so good, might look so cool and inviting. You might be pulled by your peer pressure within that environment to go out and do something. If you are not having the bare necessities of life within the particular family unit in which you're living in and you're out just trying to do right, and someone says, well, if you just walk down the street and drop this bag off of that bag, you can get paid more than you would have gotten and could survive. So that kind of pulls you in a way to the proscriptive, inappropriate norm that is bad and wrong as a value. This is what happens within the culture in which we live in. There are so many things that just pulls you because parents might have good values and prescriptive norms for their children, and they start off doing the right thing and going about life in the right way, going to school. But then other things out there pull you.
Right.
And I think everybody, and when we adapt to that so much that the prescriptive norm that is inappropriate and wrong, if a number of people start doing it over and over again, then they start perceiving that as being right. So to be a part of the gang or to rob and kill or to get involved within the drug culture, and if you're making it in that way, you start thinking that those ways are right if you can't have the standard way of doing it, or you can't even perceive a standard good way, prescriptive norm of doing it appropriate that's going to bring you success. Because at the end of the day, people have to survive. And if the other way that's going against the norm or in inappropriate rules and regulations, then you have a tendency to follow that.
True. I experienced that or witnessed that when I taught in the public schools. You know, you had young people who came to school who really, I believe, desired to learn and to grow. But that desire was in conflict with the culture of the particular school I was at, because there were so many young people who operated from proscriptive rules and norms that if you came in trying to go by the rules, man, you're going to be run out of the place.
Absolutely. And I think it's it's much more difficult for the African-American male because you have to try to adapt to that proscriptive. If not, you are looked at as being not conforming, or you're not cool, or you're not all these other things unless you do that. And even if you're trying to do the right thing, the peer pressure there, the mere culture, pulls you from doing it in order to just to survive.
Right. Doc, would that explain how a young person who has skill and talent and intelligence can get caught up in the game in the streets? Could that explain that?
Yes, it does. It really does. Because there's something that it's not visible. It's unseen. It's just something that you're trying to walk down the street from point A to point B, doing the right thing. And in your way, you might see some peer group people that might have the bling on, or they might have a little cash on them, and then you just saying hello, and they say, hey, if you just do this and do this, then you can have some of that too. And we are so attracted in many instances by the material. If I may just make a distinction between material culture and non-material culture, and material culture, all those things within a capitalistic society that attract us. And so if it's some new Michael Jordan tennis shoes or anything else, you might want them. And if someone else said, well, if you do these things, you can get them, you'll be pulled to do that. Now, the non-material culture items are those things that we encourage in education. And there's nothing that you walk out there with any more food or any more material things by learning. It's something that's growth, and we make a distinction between immediate gratification and deferred gratification. And that deferred gratification is when you're going through the educational programs and you're learning, you're developing yourself with the hopes of going to undergraduate school and then getting out. And that's, you talk about from 1 through 12 years of graduating and then 4 more years, and when all of that other material stuff is dangling before you, and if you don't have parents that can balance that by giving you that as a reward or giving you some of those things, it will pull an individual to do something wrong to in order to try to get it. Even though the parents' values, which is good and prescriptive, it will still make that child go with the peer group. And
That's right.
Yeah. So that's the major problem. You know, I really like the commentary of the Reverend that called him, because he was a former athlete, and I was too. And I just know how, in many instances, when you're experiencing that, you can try to do things one way, but then you can be pulled by other groups out there that just deters you. It pulls you. And that's one of the big problems we have within. And then the culture of poverty, you know, has a tendency to be a unique situation within itself. People adapt to it and not even feel like that they're in it, but there's so much inequity there that causes deviance to occur.
Right.
And we don't even see the deviance as even being deviant. It's just a way of life. And then that becomes a perpetual way of getting involved in gangs and crimes and homicide rates when we look at the disproportionate amount of African Americans being killed daily in urban areas because of homicide. You know, in many instances, because of the breakdown in the family structure, not having the proper economics within the community. So I know in the commentary that you've done in the past and looking at history, at an earlier time when we were gainfully with businesses within the community, things were just a lot better. But when we lost that economic structure with business and being employed and then people having jobs, it really brought a breakdown in the African American family.
Right.
And that caused a lot of problems.
What I'd like to do is, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to, I apologize. I hope I wasn't rude and cutting you off there.
No, not at all.
Doc, what the focus of this educational lecture series is to provide some solutions. So what I'd like to do is to play another announcement and come back. And let's talk about some answers.
Okay.
We've identified what the root of the problem is, and we recognize that there are indeed frustration, right? And we've even identified who's frustrated and to some degree what they're frustrated at or what they tend to target their frustrations toward. So we have another about 28 minutes here. For the rest of the show, let's talk about some solution-oriented concepts here. But let me go to a little commercial break here, and on the other side, that we'll have a conversation about that.
Okay.
All righty.
Hello, listeners. This is your host, Reverend Reuben Dockery. Thank you for tuning in to Talk Straight on Blog Talk Radio. Here, you can share your thoughts as well as become informed about very important social issues confronting society today. Please take the time to visit my website at bfcinstitute.com. That's bfcinstitute.com to learn more about our efforts to educate, inspire, and empower disadvantaged families across America to improve the quality of life. best way to stay in the loop of future broadcasts, times and locations for our traveling educational lecture series, and innovative ideas, is to become a BFC Institute seminar participant. You may do so by clicking the Join Our Group tab on the home page. I would be delighted to respond to your suggestions and engage you further in most transformative information. Again, thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hearing from you online.
High dropout rates
low test scores. And then, but the present, we still have high dropout rates and low test scores. There's this one theory that by Piaget, and he said that we move through four cognitive development stages. And I'm saying this as a potential positive recommendation that if we understood this, I think we could make some improvements as an intervention.
Okay.
But that the first developmental stage comes, say, during the 9 months of pregnancy. We have to, as a community, stay in good health, eat right, exercise, you know, do some reading tools as a child during the 9 months of pregnancy, listening to music, you know, staying in good shape, eating well. And then after birth, he would say the sensory motor stage from birth to age two. It's going to be very important that the listeners know it with new children to then try to read to them, to do positive reinforcement things. And then from that next stage of the operational stage, from 7 to 12, to be positive, to have good reinforcement, to the extent possible, involved in the church and church activities, reinforcing everything in the positive way. And then that next level, it says from that 7 years old to 12, it's called the concrete operational stage, where you can add, multiply, subtract, and divide. But again, families need to be reinforcing in education, exposing children during the summer in reading and being involved in the church and doing activities that are educational, going to the library, you know, making sure they have a reading curriculum. If they're in community centers, having people to help out there with them doing academic activities. And then that last stage is from 12 until where we are right now and older. That's called the formal operational stage, and that's when you should be able to think abstractly. Now, here's a problem that's hurting us. With postmodernism and computers, it only takes the third level of the concrete operational to work your phones, to work computers. And it takes a higher level of cognitive development to read, to abstract, to talk like we are talking tonight, have an interest in theories or whatever you want to do. And that's still what society and workload is calling for. But I'm hoping that our listening audience will understand that if we have children that are developed, we have to engage them and reinforce studying at home with the parents. Not only thing that you can take them to school, and the school does everything, parental involvement has to take place. Having them involved in the church, that has to take place. And all of that, I think, will help us as a recommendation.
Doc, I'm glad you said that. That's a great segue into this piece. We're fortunate to have an arrangement with the Davidson County Juvenile Court. And it's, the program is entitled Parent Empowerment Initiative. And I appreciate you going through Jean Piaget's research because that's right on point. That's right on point. This is a local-based initiative. Of course, it needs funding, and the courts are willing to refer individuals to us and work with us. Reverend Waller was one of our breakout presenters at a conference we held a couple of months ago. And I said that to say that this traveling lecture series is in part in design for people to help us to do this work and to get the historical lecture and other background information out so that we can understand how to move toward progress and success as opposed to staying in one being frustrated. I want to invite people to go to my website. It is bfcinstitute.com. It is bfcinstitute.com, and there is where we have our information about the traveling lecture series. But more importantly, if you would go to Educational Initiatives, hover over that, and then go down to the Parent Empowerment Initiative, what you'll see is the information there and how you can securely contribute through PayPal and things of that nature. But again, what's most important is that we're looking to go to 10 cities across America, and each of those cities have some of the same characteristics that we see right here in Nashville.
Absolutely.
Because our study, our study began here in Nashville, and what we have done is to parlay the socioeconomic circumstances of this area with other cities such as Chicago, Indianapolis, St. Louis, the Ferguson area, Penrose community of St. Louis, New Orleans and Houston, Texas, Liberty City in Miami, Florida, in that region. So there are other places, and we do have some things that you can, if you are not interested in attending the lecture or the seminar, you can support us by just purchasing some of our items, and you can see those by going to a contact page and going down to our back store and see those. And incidentally, Reverend Waller's book is there, Still High. Dr. Sanford, he is gracious enough to work with us to use some of the funds from his book to support our effort as well. So we're grateful for everything that he does in his presence there. So, but yes, it's important that we realize that the help we've been waiting on is here, because the help we've been waiting on is ourselves.
Yes.
And if we look to anyone else other than, you're not going to get it.
You're
That's
right.
correct. My goodness. That's correct.
Reverend Waller, you want to share something there?
Yeah, I'd like to say, I was just thinking about it when you all were talking about the solution, and I looked at my book on page 28, man, and I got feeling kind of bad. And I oftentimes would do that. Part of the growth I have to get through, when I look at something, I just pop the book open and notice something here. And if you don't mind, I'll share it with you. Just a little bit.
Okay. We have a few minutes.
Yeah, it says, when money starts to flow at a rapid speed, like I was experiencing, I didn't take the time to think about how out of control my life had become.
Mm-hmm.
Time and my reputation as being one of the top dealers in the area continued to flourish. A title I didn't want, but I couldn't escape. My network and territory also continued to increase. The lifestyle and reputation that came with it was out of my control.
Mm-hmm.
One thing didn't change, though, my determination and desire to be the best, a value I held close when I was a young boy. The reason I was sharing that is that in sports, I always desired to be the best that I could be. And when I got captured and into the lifestyle and got, next thing I was in bondage, and I wanted to be the best at what I was doing, and I think it's such a miserable lifestyle. And I just know it's a lot of people that's crying out to try to escape. And we just have to do it again, the things that can be done. And I have to learn how to accept what I can't change. But there's a lot of things that can be changed. And that is another avenue. We can go down another avenue. And multitudes of people's lives can be used through the effort that you're putting out there, Pastor Doctor. And also, Doctor, that you have on the panel today, man. I just
Dr.
encourage
Sanford.
Dr. Sanford?
Yes,
Sanford.
I mean, say it again?
Yes.
Yes.
No, go
I'm
ahead.
Encouraged
you
by,
just recognize
I'm encouraged by what you all are sharing here. And I just, I just popped the book open and discovered that there was a miserable lifestyle I was living, you know, with all the finances and all the materialistic things that I acquired. When I look back over it and I found out how out of control my life was, and when I got free, I thought about my community.
Yeah.
And I said I could no longer sell another drop of that stuff that was destroying us. And I got delivered from selling drugs in 1997, man. And I just think it's an awesome thing, you know, to reach out and to extend a hand to others who are caught up and captured and don't know how to get free. And so I just want to encourage the people, man. Just be encouraged to know that there is hope, and it's something that we can do.
Right.
Support it, right? Yeah.
Okay. I think it's important, gentlemen, to mention that not everybody battles with drugs and or alcohol. But as Dr. Sanford alluded to earlier, sometimes it's just social depression. The stressors of life that cause many people not to function very well and to shut down. And so we really look at this thing holistically. We realize, as I like what Doc was saying about the focus on building the family. Bill Inslee writes about that black family and the need to focus on reinstituting and building that up as a major focus for forward progress. So I think it's important to mention that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, very much. Very much so.
We have about 10 minutes. We have about 10 minutes left, gentlemen. You guys have been great. We appreciate you. I want to give each of you an opportunity to, but particularly Dr. Sanford, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of sum things up a little bit. I know you and I continue to work. In fact, we're looking forward to coming back and presenting to your classes there again, and to work with ESU on it. But if you will, just kind of give us some final words or thoughts here before we cut out for tonight.
Okay. I would just like to say, in the notion of how we started the conversation of frustration of America, it's so ingrained in the very fabric of our culture. From 244 years of enslavement here in America, 81 years of Jim Crow laws, the segregation, and the movement, there's just so many things that have broken down the very fabric or the institutions that are supposed to be supportive of helping communities to develop. And with that breakdown, in instances, it causes a lot of the problems that we are seeing today with the incarceration of the majority of African-American males in prison, the high homicide rate. Those things are just a part of the culture that's been a manifestation from something that occurred a long time ago. And we have to understand the problem and the reoccurring patterns before we can do something about it. And I think tonight's conversation has led us to a good way of understanding it, from a very good example from the Reverend that spoke, you know, being a star athlete, but getting involved in pool. We can even think about maybe a popular film that people have seen, that Notorious B.I.G. And if you think about him, he had a mom that had a nice little place for him to live and took him to the little private school. But almost as your guest mentioned, as he walked back home, the environment pulled him to do other things and end up getting in trouble. So this is the problem that exists. And we still have, as Dr. Du Bois was talking about, the double consciousness, how we have to be American and African-American and try to understand the best of our history and our legacy in order to move forward. And I think that's a very important element to it as well.
Amen.
Okay. All right. Reverend Wally, you want a closing thought there before we get out of here?
Yes, I would just like to just share, if you will, a scripture based on what is going on this day about being enslaved. A person become a slave. Romans 6:16 states very clear, and this translation says, "Don't you realize that you become the slave of whatever you choose to obey?" And it gave me a chance to look back and think about when I was enslaved by a chemical that controlled my life, and now when I got free, I am a slave for righteousness now, and I'm striving to just continue to let people know that it's okay to become a slave of something righteous, man. I think when we get our communities together and become that slave of all the gifts and talents that we do have and start exercising, and then you would find out how to slowly, gradually remove that bondage of unrighteousness that's keeping our communities bound. I just wanted to share that. The day is still hope. All right. I just wanted to let the people know to be encouraged.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I'll kind of wrap up here by first giving an announcement. Our next show will be November the 1st, Tuesday, November the 1st, 7 o'clock. And we want to talk about then family unity. I appreciate you, Dr. Sanford, for bringing us into that, because that's a key point.
Oh, yeah.
We want to talk about family unity, and we'll pick up that following Thursday with a related theme. We'll announce our guest that you can come back here and archive the show. For those of you who couldn't tune in with us tonight, you can always come back and archive the show and hear the whole show in full. And be sure to stay with us on Facebook, on Twitter, and via email there. But I also would like to encourage our listening audience, those that are listening live or who would archive and listen later, to support our calls. And be sure to go to our website, and that's bfcinstitute.com, bfcinstitute.com, and take time to register as a member with us. There's no cost to do that. But we would like for you to be a contributor and a supporter for what we're doing. As you do so, you enable us to implement the strategies for our Parent Empowerment Initiative in Nashville, Davidson County, and to travel abroad with our lecture series to raise funds for that initiative as well. And I just want to mention that we have a crime intervention advocacy piece where we move from just conversation, gentlemen, to action in those cities that we go to, because we'll conduct public workshops and forums and think tank sessions to help people with the specific issues in each of their individual cities to come up with some strategies and solutions based on the people that are at the table there when we engage them. So those are things that we certainly want to encourage our listening audience to be aware of. And again, you can contribute to our calls. If you're not able to make our sessions or anything and you still want to support us, you can go to the contact link, hover over it, and go down to the bookstore, the back page store, rather, and choose from several items there that you can give. Once you contribute at a certain amount beyond $100, we have a gift package for you. Actually, we have a gift package for you beyond $50, but between $50 and $100, there's a special gift package. And you look at that backstory and see some of those things. But again, what's most important is we thank you for listening to us here on Talk Straight. And tonight our conversation was social frustration. I hope we offer some information that's useful to those that are in our earshot and those who may listen later. Dr. Sanford, thank you so much, sir, for your time.
And thank you so much
for
I enjoyed it.
Sir, we look forward to engaging you more. Reverend Waller, thanks for calling in and chiming in with us here. And with that, gentlemen, we thank you, and we're going to go to another commercial announcement and look forward to see everyone or hear from everyone on November the 1st, 2016 at 7 o'clock p.m. right here at Talk Straight with this educational lecture series. Again, this is your host, Reuben Dockery, and I thank every one of you for coming and joining us, and we ask you to come back with us on the 1st of November. And again, thank you and good night.
Hey, they call me Pook. I'm from these streets. Somehow, I live to see my 18th birthday. I managed to graduate from juvenile detention to adult prison. People try to tell me I should grow up be a man. But I'm the best man I know. Somebody asked, where I see myself 10 years. Man, I'm just trying to survive these streets day by day.
America. Please support our traveling educational lecture series addressing perceived threats to African American males. To learn more, please visit us at bfcinstitute.com. That is bfcinstitute.com. Simply click the red sticker for details.